Thanks very much, Nyanadara. And very good to be with all my brothers here, some of whom are very old friends. Chintamani, I was ordained with. Archula, I was remembering. A surprise to see him here. He worked at Sukhavati for a while. Devamitra's there. Wonderful to see all my friends here, and especially to see my five Indian fellow preceptors here. There's now five men Indian public preceptors, so I can retire. They may not let me. I had a very, very striking experience just a couple of weeks ago. Many of you know that I have an interest in a group of Mitras working in northern Hungary. They're Roma. They like to call themselves Gypsies rather than Roma for reasons of internal nomenclature. And they run a school called the Dr. Ambedkar High School in northern Hungary. It's an extremely poor area of Europe, although not the poorest. Just across the border in Slovakia, I've seen Gypsies in much, much, much worse conditions. But they are very, very highly marginalised. They're strongly repressed. For instance, in the village where our school is, there are 3,000 people living, 1,000 of whom are Gypsies. There are 25 police. They're not there for the 2,000 white Hungarians. And there's a very serious shift towards a nationalist or kind of quasi-fascist government. It's almost universal, something at 70-80% of the population vote for a right wing that makes the Conservative Party look like the Communist Party. Well, actually, that's not fair, because the Communist Party in Hungary is with the rightists as well. So it's a very, very unpleasant and depressed situation. Something like 90% of 95-97% of Gypsies are unemployed. The general population has very high unemployment, about 30-40%. But in that area, almost all Gypsies are unemployed, or unemployed in really virtually slave labour, just working for the local council, sweeping roads. They're extremely ignorant. Many of the students coming to the university, to the high school, have been through primary school, but by the time they arrive in the high school, they don't know how to read and write, because all that happens in the schools is they're kept under control so the white kids can learn. Over the border in Slovakia, where we do some work too, it's much, much worse. I've seen human beings living in circumstances that, well, human beings should just not have to live like that, living in rubbish heaps, in hutments. But in Slovakia, which has very severe winters, next to open sewers, strongly harassed by the police, it's heart-rending to see. So I go a couple of times a year to support our Mitras, and I don't really do very much. I don't speak Hungarian. I don't really understand their culture. It's very different to ours. I come from a very privileged section of a very privileged part of the world. I've never suffered oppression. I've never suffered exclusion. I've always been sort of part of or close to the establishment, if you like. I've had a pretty good life. I don't really understand the dynamics that are around them. But slowly, just by going there regularly, we've become friends. I like to think they trust me and believe that I'm with them. I just keep going. Often I can't do very much. They've got permanent crises. They're trying to run a school in a very remote part of Europe, which has very few facilities, where they're having to hire teachers from a labour market where anybody who's got any qualifications gets out, gets to Budapest, or even better, to London. London is supposed to be the second biggest Hungarian city in the world. I think that's a hyperbole. But so that constant crisis within the school, the constant crisis with the local government, which is dominated by Jobbik, which is a explicitly anti-Semitic, anti-Gypsy party. So, you know, we're doing something and suddenly they have to go out and deal with a crisis of some kind or other. So I must say, over the years, I've wondered what I'm doing, why I'm going there, and what I can really contribute. My strongest talent, I suppose, is for talking about the Dhamma, and I don't get a lot of chance for doing that. But this time we were talking about their pedagogical philosophy. I know nothing about education as a philosophy, if you like. I've not studied that area at all. And, of course, it's an extremely sophisticated and well-developed area. And because they're dealing with people who, as they put it, are being given... these are people being given a second chance who never had a first chance. And so they have to use very sophisticated... well, not sophisticated, but they have to use very appropriate... forms of education. I know nothing about it. But what we were doing was sort of looking at what they're doing in the light of very fundamental Dhammic principles and trying to come up with a sort of principles on which their school would be founded. We came up in the end with 9 principles: Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, liberty, equality, fraternity, and educate, agitate, organize. The Ambedkarites will recognize all of this. And then, of course, relating all that, all of those, to each other, which was just very inspiring. And at a certain point, while they were talking, you know, everything goes through Hungarian, and with quite a bit of teasing and joking and quite a lot of mobile phones in operation. At a certain point, I realized that I don't have to do anything at all. I often feel I've got to try to leave some impression or move them on or something like that. And I realized this time very, very forcibly and dramatically, I don't have to do anything at all. In a certain sense, I can't do anything. I've been in the classroom with them. I just can't survive there. I can if Tibor or Janos are with me, because they translate and the students are completely in awe of them. But on my own, I've got nothing really to contribute. But what I realized is that I carry in me something that's far more than me. In a way, what I could say is I carry all of you. I carry Bhante. I carry the 3 jewels, not because I hold them in my mind or something like that, but because I'm committed to the 3 jewels, because I have, you know, soaked myself to a fair degree in the Dhamma and in the Sangha. I sort of carry that in me, and I'm able. It's not that I am able, but that I do link them to that. I don't do anything. I just link them to that, so that they sense their connection to something much larger, sort of through me. Now, I want to make it absolutely clear, this is sort of nothing to do with me. You know, I've got my talents, I've got my skills, I've got a great deal of experience, I've been an order member for a very long time. And yes, I do have quite a bit of talent in that sort of way. But at the same time, all of you are very well aware of my faults, because you read Shabda. And, you know, I make no pretensions to anything at all. I do my best. I know I'm not a genius or very highly this or that or the other. So it's not to do with me, really. It's to do with my having sort of immersed myself to the degree that I've been able in this atmosphere of the order. And I carry that with me. We carry that with us. And in that context, I experience that more sort of fully than I usually do. I experience it in India, but in India, everybody is very, very receptive to the Dhamma. Even if they don't know Tri Ratna, it's very easy to make connections with people and bring them out. I'm sure that those on the front line, so to speak, in India do experience this. For instance, I've just taken on a new secretary. Maitreya Nagarjuna has gone back to university to his lectureship. And I've just taken on a new secretary who's a very bright young man from Orissa, which is an eastern state, which is one of the most backward in India, and known for its intense casteism. And he comes from central Orissa, a very, very poor, backward area. And he just started to sort of stand up for himself. He says that his first experience of sort of struggle was that in the playground, the upper caste kids wouldn't let the Dalits play. If there were teams being chosen, they wouldn't choose Dalits, and they would keep them off the pitch, the cricket pitch, of course, and they wouldn't let them join in. So he and his mates, they made sure they were included. And often Dalits are pretty tough because they do menial work, so they're quite tough. So they fought their way into the pitch, and that was the beginning of his sort of Ambedkarite struggle. And then through that, he made connections with political Ambedkarism. And then through that, he made a connection with Tri Ratna, especially through Nagaloka, which is presumably where Achara knows him. And through Nagaloka, he made contact with the order and asked to be an order member, and a very fine young man. But he said that as soon as he met people from Tri Ratna, he sort of realized this is what he wanted. This is what he was looking for. He felt a different quality. He felt something of a nature that went beyond mere political struggle. And I'm sure this every one of you could sort of tell stories of that kind, where you in your own person have brought somebody into contact with something that's far more than you. You've played your part, maybe. Maybe you've done it skillfully. Sometimes people come despite us. They feel something through us, even though we make it really hard for them. Fortunately. So I found myself deeply moved by this and sort of greatly heartened. Otherwise, I carry a tremendous burden. You know, how can I get it across? What can I do? In a way, I don't have to bother. What I have to do is sort of get out of the way and try to connect and try to find circumstances and opportunities. In Hungary, it's very like that. I don't know what the program's going to be. I don't know where I'm going to be when I arrive. I don't even ask anymore. I'm just taken where I'm taken. I'm put where I'm put. I'm called when I'm called. And I'm sent away again when I'm sent away again. And I just wait, like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in the famous play by Tom Stoppard. Suddenly the play happens and I'm a part of it. And then suddenly I'm standing in the wings waiting. But if I'm prepared just to wait and just remain open, not get upset, not get proud, not get, sort of wanting to do something, something comes through. And it's humbling, gives great confidence and, great pride in a way, and a positive pride. Of course, I see that in England. I mean, I just come from the LBC, and you feel that same force there, very much shared between people who operate within it, as it were, from it. And I've seen people coming for the first time into the LBC. 2 years ago, I was sitting in a meeting the council, and in one of those very rare moments where it didn't engage me fully, very rare moments, so I glanced through the glass windows into the lobby, and there's a young woman standing there. It's a black woman, as it happens. She had this most wonderful smile on her face. It's hard to express what that smile communicated, but was obviously of extraordinary wonder and delight. Afterwards, when I came out, she came up to me and she said, I've just been told that you're somebody who had a lot to do with setting up this place. And I just want to tell you, this is my first moment in this centre. And immediately I came, I felt there's something really special here. And I'm very, very pleased I saw her this time. And she's a Mitra and engaging more and more deeply. So there is this mysterious something that we all, as it were, carry in us and that carries us, that's far more than us, and that none of us can take any individual pride in, as it were, but that we can all take a sort of pride in the most positive sense in, and a delight in, and have a great deal of confidence in. And that is this mysterious something that Bhante, at the end of both those interviews in 2009-2010, referred to. In 2009, he said, after going through what is the Western Buddhist order in a certain amount of quite challenging detail, actually all he was doing was reminding us of what he's been saying all the way through. Even he mentioned the word disciple, I noticed, in my relation to the order in 1994. Four or something like that, maybe even earlier. I don't know how people can think they're surprised and they weren't told this. It's been there all along. But at the end of that paper, he says, we must never forget that there's something about it all that cannot be pinned down, that can't be buttoned down. There's something that can't be completely defined. There's something that can't be fitted into a schema of words and formulae and so on. At the end of the second set of interviews, which were much more personal, if you remember, he said that, something like, but you must remember that there's something about me, Sangharakshita, and therefore about the order that cannot be pinned down, that cannot be completely encapsulated. And what I think he means by the lineage of inspiration is this. I've seen the lineage of inspiration discussed in terms of Kalyanamitrata. Well, of course it is Kalyanamitrata, but in a way, Kalyanamitrata is the medium for that lineage of inspiration, rather than being the lineage. If you see what I mean, that the what it is that Kalyanamitrata, what makes Kalyanamitrata Kalyanamitrata, is that element of what he calls in the lineages the lineage of inspiration. It's that certain something that can never be fully defined. That isn't in merely the teachings, it isn't merely in the practices, it's not even in the responsibilities that we take on, in other words, in the responsibilities that uphold our institutions. It's something within those and beyond those, but it lives through those if they are effective, but it's more than those. Without that something, the lineages of teaching, the lineage of practice, the lineage of responsibility are useless. They're dead. Without that element of a certain something extra, they are almost worse than nothing. They can even become harmful, restrictive. But of course, because it's a spirit, as Bhante famously said, that bloweth where it listeth, quoting from St. Paul. You can't, it's not easy to sort of pinpoint what it is or how it's kept alive or anything of that kind. And it, what has been really in my mind very strongly in this year as we've entered Bante's 90th year, his 10th decade, is the way in which he has sort of brought that lineage to life. And probably few in this room will remember that, apart from maybe Chintamani and Deva Mitra, but I remember the very, very early experiences I had going to our centre in central London, in 14 Monmouth Street, going in there, and there was just one middle-aged Englishman with long hair and a slightly grubby robe. That's all there was. And, you know, pretty much the whole movement at that time was in these two rooms in the basement, 20, 30 people. I remember shortly after we were ordained and just when Deva Mitra was ordained, the first order convention at Aryatara, where we all sat round the walls of the front room at Aryatara. It must have been no more than 20 people, the two or three missing. And the extraordinary thing is that right from the start, right from my first contact with Bante, almost below the level, well, no, definitely below the level of my own conscious recognition, Bante was passing this on, was communicating this. Just as I, in my humble way in going to Hungary, am sort of passing on that spirit to our Hungarian Mitras and Gypsy Mitras, Bante did it, through unpromising would-be hippies in the late 60s. And he never spoke about that. He just was himself in interaction with us. As far as we know, he didn't really have a clear idea of what he was doing, if you see what I mean. He didn't have a worked out plan. Well, he said, I didn't have a worked out plan. Very often what he did was articulate what was happening after it had started happening, if you see what I mean. So he would acknowledge what was unfolding and give it a way of being structured, a way of being thought about, but it was already there. So when he talked about it, he'd be talking about what was already evident. I remember very clearly, Chintamani must have been there, maybe Deva Mitra was, but he gave a set of talks, Sagramati might have been there, he gave a set of talks in Brighton, which has been published as Buddhism for Today and Tomorrow. Were you there, Archer? Ratnaprabha was, of course he was. It's in the Brighton Pavilion. So we were all sitting on these spindly reproduction Regency chairs, which one felt a little sort of lumpy for. And we those of us working at the LBC, Sukhavati, as we would say in those days, been working all day, and we jump in the purple van and race down to Brighton. Prakasha might have been there, yeah. And we'd go and sit on these spindly chairs, and Bante gave these four talks, a vision of existence, no, method of personal development, a vision of human existence, etc. Was it? A blueprint for a new society, but there's one before that, isn't it? A nucleus of a new society, yes. A new world, thank you very much. You see, it has been handed on, yes. more effectively than... at that time, we were all working together at Sukhavati. We used to call the whole building Sukhavati because that was part of our myth that we were creating the Pure Land. And Bante described what we were doing. If you see what I mean, he gave what we were doing a conscious form, a way that we could understand and think about it. So at no point did one feel, oh, I didn't realise that. It was more that one felt, oh yeah, that's what it is, if you see what I mean. As if he was giving articulation to one's own sort of background assumption, which one could never have heaved into words for oneself. And the whole movement has come out of that. Bhante just gradually channeling, to put it that way, something that is more than him, but that he has been the medium for the transmission, and that we have gradually picked up and brought more and more to life. And perhaps almost worth just stopping there and just contemplating what Bhante did so unassumingly, if you see what I mean. There were fireworks, but they were of a different kind, as it were. Bhante, very sort of measured, very steady. He could be pretty wild, but his general progress was so steady, so careful, so thoughtful, always dropping in at the right moment what suited the moment. And one realizes now that he hardly thought about it, if you see what I mean. It just arose. So he'd then talk about it. So, for instance, when we were in the middle of the project at the LBC, when it was getting pretty tough, we'd run out of money, we'd overstretched our skills base. In other words, we'd overstretched Attila. It was getting, really quite difficult. Difficult to keep going, difficult to keep one's head up. Bhante gave those series of lectures on the Sutra of Golden Light. And again, it was very clear in listening to those talks that something more was happening than, an exposition of a sutra, as it were. And Bhante's spoken later, hasn't he, in his study in the what's now the office where Sihamanas works at the LBC, that while he was writing, the four great kings were all around him. He was conscious of them as presences all around him. Bhante has this tremendous power to mediate what is belongs, if you like, to the world of imagination, the spiritual world, the dhammic world, and to bring it to life in a very calm, very earthed way. If you see what I mean. He never takes flights of fancy. Well, he does, of course, but they're always sort of within a context that means that they can't be misunderstood or relatively difficult to misunderstand them. So I thought, amongst other things, it was just worth at this particular time and this particular year with Bhante just a few yards from us, just to remember that, to sort of focus on that. What he's fundamentally done for us is to channel something that is more than him, and that he's brought to life in our order and brought to life in us. And to be honest, that's what I live for. That's what my Dharma life is for. I don't do it as well as I should. I'm not making any pretensions or claims. But that's what I'm interested in. Aphoristically, I could say I'm not really interested in meditation. I'm not really interested in insight. I'm not really interested in mindfulness. I'm not really interested in study. I'm not even interested in working for the Dhamma. I'm only interested in those things because they enable me to participate in something far greater than me. Do you see what I mean? Don't misunderstand me. All of these things have no value in themselves. Meditation without something beyond meditation is just a technique, personal experience. Insight, if it's not getting yourself out of the way so that something greater than you can flow in and through you and you can participate in something greater than you, is just my insight. Mindfulness, If mindfulness is not contained within a framework of mindfulness of reality, in Bhante's terminology, that is of something that transcends me, my body, my feelings, my thoughts, my mental processes, is just another useful technique. Good. I'm glad people do that. And, you know, I'm not saying it's not good to teach them that. But unless that's linked to something supervenient, it's ho-hum. And it's the same with everything that we do. If you're studying the Dhamma and it's not related to something, let's say, transcendent, it's just academic. It's just the exercise of the intellect. And probably useful. Probably does enlarge human understanding and experience. I'm decrying none of these things. I'm saying I have not the faintest interest in them in that way. Straight up. I'm interested in them, and I am interested in them. I've been practicing mindfulness very badly all my life, all my Dhamma life. I've been practicing meditation assiduously and hopelessly. Every day, I've hardly missed a day for 40 years, 45 years. I've been practicing insight ever since I encountered the Dhamma. You know, when I sort of read what people talk about sometimes, I went through the gate before I was ordained. I thought that's what you had to do. Do you see what I mean? I had a hit of reality right at the start. That's why I'm in the order. And of course, insight isn't a moment. Of course it isn't. That's a very uninsightful way of thinking about insight. Insight is a process of ever deepening penetration of the nature of conditioned reality, of the world of appearance. It's a penetration of the world of appearance so that, forgive my metaphor, what goes beyond the world of appearance can live through you. All of these things. You know, there's no point. You know, I've given my life to working for the institutions of the movement and the order. It gives me great satisfaction on a merely human level. My father was a naval officer, after all. But it's just not interested in building a, you know, converting a ruined fire station for its own sake. You know, I got a certain amount of satisfaction from it for its own sake, but it's not enough. It's got to be for something more than me. Life for me is not worth living. It's, in fact, I would strongly recommend stopping it, if you see what I mean. If it's just for me, it's not worth it. Constantly, I think we need to open up to what is beyond all the different, very important, very good, very crucial elements of practice and our life together. Open up to something that's much beyond them and that is intangible, indefinable, and that is what gives us so much greater power than we have individually. If I went to Hungary on my own, I could do nothing. I just don't have any relevant skills to really help those, you know, for instance, Slovakian gypsies living in hell. I just don't have anything. When I went there for the first time, it's Singhamanas. I think I remember saying to Singhamanas, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to stay here. You know, I cannot leave human beings living like this. I must do something. And then very quickly the realization comes, what would I do? I speak neither Slovak, which they hardly speak, nor Hungarian, which they don't speak very well, nor Romani, which is their everyday language, and they live in Slovakia. What can I do? What I can do is be a link to our gypsy mitras who have a natural connection with them and have skills to set up a school where some of those can come. And several of the boys from that Slovak village are now in the school in Hungary. One of them came over to a retreat with me in Wales, and then came down to the LBC, and he loved it. So delightful. He wanted to see the sea. He'd never seen the sea. Because if you live in Slovakia, there's no sea. So we drove him to the coast in Wales, and he went and sort of put his hand in the sea. And he wanted to know where it was, as it were. He had no idea of where it was, so we had to try and show him on a map. You know, because I'm linked to all of you, and we are all linked to something more than us that Bhante has brought to life, and that lives now in the order, in a sense, independently of Bhante. Well, definitely independently of Bhante, otherwise we're doomed. Although never unrelated to Bhante, otherwise we're doomed. I'm able to offer something of what we are to those very, very worse than poor people in the worst conditions I've ever seen human beings living in. And I lived in Africa as a child, and I've spent time in India. I've seen worse physical conditions in India, but I've never seen such isolation and intense segregation. Even Dalits in a village are part of the village, albeit in a, you know, an unpleasant and subsidiary role, but they're part of the village and often have relations with people across the village. But here they had no relations with Hungarians. For instance, I must keep myself under control because I get rather sort of moved by all this. But in the village where we're working, there are 3,000 people, 2,000 Hungarians, 1,000 gypsies. If I walk down the road with a gypsy, no Hungarian will even look at me. Not even look at me. They'll walk past me as if we're in different, you know, programs, as it were, different films. And every gypsy I walk past will smile and nod at the gypsy I'm with. And sometimes at me, because they know I'm connected. If I walk down on my own, every white person I pass, every Hungarian I pass, says, Jónapot kívánok, and I say, Jónapot kívánok, good morning, and very politely. It's so striking. These people have lived together for thousands or hundreds of years, and yet they occupy completely different worlds in the same village. And I'm able, because of my connection with the order, my connection with Bhante, my connection with the Dhamma, through that, I'm able to channel that to them. So, as you can probably imagine, I'm passionate about this remaining alive. I'm passionate about it. I believe that for it to remain alive costs a certain amount of effort from us all, if you see what I mean. I believe that's the challenge that confronts us right now. I think for a long time we were held together by Bhante, if you see what I mean. You know, we all had some relationship with Bhante, even sometimes a negative relationship with Bhante, but we still sort of related to the whole through Bhante. And, you know, there were small enough numbers of us to pretty much identify everybody. And then we went through a bit of a meltdown in the early 2000s. And Bhante, of course, stepped back into illness and was out of the way for a while. And quite a turbulent period ensued, which, you know, fortunately, we came out of with Bhante reasserting, redefining what the order was. Actually, it wasn't redefining, it was simply reminding us of what it had always been, what it had been when we joined it. I was astonished reading my relationship to the order the other day. I do recommend people do so, because, you know, if you think that what Bhante said in What is the Western Buddhist Order was radical and revolutionary or whatever, he said it all then in 1994, and then followed that up with extending the hand of fellowship, defining our relationship to the wider Buddhist world. No doubt that needs more precision because that world has changed quite a bit. But the principles are very clear. So Bhante simply sort of re-reminded us. And basically what he did, and it must have cost him a huge amount of energy at a time when his own energy was in crisis, he re-channeled and sort of re-earthed, like lightning, brought back to earth what the order was. And, you know, of course, many had carried on just on that assumption, but enough of us had lost the plot for it to be needed to be reasserted. What's happening, of course, now is that we're facing these very long, slow days of approaching Bhante's departure, which his gift to us is to do it very, very slowly, intentionally or not, so that we're sort of, by the time it happens, we'll be kind of used to it, I think. It seems to me that what faces us all is a kind of conscious choice. We need to consciously choose whether this indefinable magic, Bhante's talked about it, doesn't he? A touch of magic, this indefinable lineage of inspiration, this unpindownable something, this special transmission outside the scriptures. I dared to invoke that phrase. Whether that is really important to us, and how important to us it is, if you see what I mean. If it's really important to us, then we will work to preserve it. And it's not a huge amount of work, it's not even a huge sacrifice. I sometimes say I've given myself up to a selfless ideal completely selfishly, if you see what I mean. I'm trying to be selfless because for selfish reasons. Do you know what I mean? Because it's to be selfish is horribly painful. It's just me. Oh, and how tiresome I am. I've often quoted my mother, confined to her bed the last 9 years of her life, with having had a stroke, being a pretty, I think the word is feisty, New Zealand lady, suddenly laid low on her bed. And I remember once going down to see her, and the first thing she said to me, "I'm sick of being me." And I knew exactly what she meant. You're just going round in the tight circle of your own ego identity. And so I want to go beyond that. Not because I'm a great martyr and I really want to. Because selfishly, it's the best thing for me, if you see what I mean, to participate in something larger than me, to give myself up to something greater than me, even in the end to sacrifice myself, if necessary, to something greater than me. That would be in my own best interests. That's the wonderful thing about the Dhamma, that it's in your own best interests to be selfless. So if you want that, if you feel that, and you want it, you need to recognise there's things to be done. He who wills the ends, wills the means. To quote no less an authority than Kant. If you want something that's worthwhile to you, you must do what's necessary to bring it about. If you want the end, then you must bring the conditions into existence. Those conditions are not that difficult. They mean that each and every one of us needs to make the effort to align our own Dhamma life with the overall Dhamma life that we share. Align it physically by coming together, by being present together. You know, 70 order members, men order members from the UK and Ireland, sorry, the Ireland and UK region is minimal. Worse than minimal. If the ladies come together, no, that doesn't work anymore. But, you know, the smaller wing of the order, 120 of them, and bookings You know, they've got reservations of, I think, 30 names on the reservation list. We've got 30 places going spare, 50 places going spare. So we need to make the effort. Maybe people are coming together in other ways, of course. We need to make the effort to come together with others, because no amount of Facebook contact substitutes for direct contact. Of course, if you have a vivid imagination, even a thought can bring you together. But face it, brothers, few of us live sufficiently powerfully on that level. We should do more and more. But being physically present together makes all the difference. And then, you know, your Facebook contact or your telephone calls or whatever, or even just your imagination of each other, can work. Aligning ourselves in terms of our practice, you know, a high degree of commonality of practice and of teaching, so that we've all done the mindfulness of breathing in the four stages. We've all done the Maitri Bhavana, not according to some whimsical new formula that somebody's struck up, which is always happening. You find sometimes you hear somebody teaching the Metta Bhavana. Is that the Metta Bhavana? You know, no doubt it's good and might be even be useful as a sort of a sidelight on what is central. But unless we've all done the same central core of practices and broadly use those and relate to those, we'll drift further and further apart. So I've had the experience of talking to order members, and they've sort of referred to it, their Dhamma experience, in terms that I'm convinced are genuine, but that I have no way of relating to. I have to get out a dictionary and probably go and study a few books you know, that have come out in the last year or two to really understand what they're talking about. Which is not to say that one may not get real inspiration from books coming out all the time. There's a lot of really interesting material coming out. But one needs to then work that back into what we share in common. And one needs to do that, work that back, you know, in dialogue with one's friends and colleagues and teachers, Kalyanamitras, and so forth. Not do what I've done so many times, read a book and then go into a class and start teaching what I've just read. I'm as guilty as anybody, probably more, because I can get away with it. But we need to sort of honour what we hold in common, because it's it enables us to share, enables us more easily to share this indefinable spirit. You could say that without the lineage of inspiration, teachings, practices and responsibilities are empty. But actually, without shared lineage of teaching, practice and responsibility, it becomes harder and harder to share the lineage of inspiration. It becomes more and more remote, and we have sort of such different transmissions of that lineage. It's very hard to feel part of the same thing. And I've experienced this in cases with people who I take very seriously. But their language is so different and are so unrelated to what is fundamental to us. It's hard to identify with it. It's all right for them, but what about the people they teach and the people I teach when they come together? And it gets more and more remote as we go down. So without compromising at all the creative and spontaneous unfolding of our own Dhamma experience, we need to constantly relate it to what we share in common. So the same with institutions. We have a certain common framework of institutions, you know, certain common roles like order convener or chair of a centre or whatever, which are defined in a roughly common way. And situations are never the same. The chair of the LBC is going to operate very differently to the chair of Cardiff, for instance, because the situations are so different. But the roles clearly overlap, and they come together. They clearly understand each other. So we need to consciously now, in a way we've never had to do before, consciously align ourselves with each other. I believe this is, first, vitally necessary and extremely worthwhile. It's a lot of work, for instance, particularly for someone like me in the Public Preceptor's College, with a certain responsibility for guarding the gates, because people are constantly nipping through the gates and then nipping back in again, with sort of Viking raids out into the world, bringing back all sorts of booty and slaves and so forth. I won't pursue the analogy. You know, it's our job as public preceptors to try to make sure we keep sufficiently in common for it to all work. And it's pretty tedious at times, especially, you know, when you get to be, you know, the teeth are getting a little longer. God, I've done that before. Oh, haven't we? I thought we dealt with that in the 60s. You know, some things I can see coming round that I remember Banty talking about in the 70s. At the Archway Centre, I remember some of the conversations that Banty would have. You know, where, for instance, he got us to take down all the other Buddhist groups' posters that we had on our boards. Because he said to us, do you know what it's like when they go to that centre? Do you know if it's really valid or not? Sorry, it's Buddhist, you know. But we didn't know. And often, you know, do you realise? You'll just confuse people because they're hearing one thing here, they hear something else there. So the issues are not new. And one gets sometimes a bit tired of it. And sometimes I thought, well, in a way, it'd be just much easier if I could just sort of get on with my own Dhamma life and, you know, let everybody else get on with their own Dhamma life. And, yeah, slowly we'd sort of diverge and, well, okay. But I realise in my own mind it's a concession to individualism, my own individualism, if you see what I mean. I define individualism as the overemphasis upon personal experience at the expense of objective context, so that one stops thinking about the context around one and one's duty to it, and one focuses increasingly on one's own rights, if you see what I mean, to put it very nattily. And of course, it's the zeitgeist, isn't it? It's the mood of the times. It's very interesting, in the Indian constitution, there's Dr. Ambedkar put in a charter of fundamental rights, but also of fundamental duties. But that's quite unusual in constitutional law, and Dr. Ambedkar clearly knew what he was doing. But in our Western culture, growing stronger and stronger and spreading, it's happening in India. Enormously fast. In fact, they're ahead of us now. The individualism is growing faster amongst the younger generation than it is here. Anyway, we won't go into the reasons for that. But individualism is the zeitgeist. We've got it in us. We came with it. In fact, Chintamani and Devamitra and I and Archer, our generation, invented it, if you see what I mean. We're to blame. We kicked against the traces. But we still had some traces to kick against. There are no traces anymore. The horses run free. Exaggerating for the sake of an image. Sagarmati was there too. You know, from the Navy to anarchism in a single bound. Actually, they were happening side by side. That's the mood of the times. And, it did mean the setting aside of false and outdated and over-rigid and over... socially hierarchical modes, jolly good, but we undervalue our duty to the world around us. The best representation of that now, of course, is environmentalism, but even that is often in a highly individualistic context. And what our order is a complete denial of either the individualistic mode or the group mode. And we need to constantly be working to overcome the individualism that's around us, that's reinforced by the films we watch, by the advertising we see, by the conversations we have, by what we read in the newspapers, by the books we read, even by the Buddhist books we read. We're constantly finding our individualism titillated. It's reinforced while being given a vision of a sort of refinement. So we have the illusion of something worthy, but in a context which is highly individualistic. So what the order offers us is a radical alternative to the way the world is going. Of course, it's a radical alternative the way the world is going here. In countries like Hungary, and to some extent it's happening in India too, that the zeitgeist is towards a nationalistic, sort of right-wing identity. Even in Central Europe, increasingly fascistic, with strong emphasis on ethnic identity. So we're also a radical rejection of group identities. So a radical rejection of group identity, a radical rejection of individualistic identity. We are affirming the third order of consciousness, which is something, a living experience. I tried to talk about it at the beginning in terms of what I felt myself to be communicating and conveying. That I tried to talk about in terms of what Bhante sort of channeled into existence. That is what the order fundamentally is. And everything we do, all the really good things we do, meditation practices, insight practices, mindfulness practices, visualization practices, all the institutional things we do, all the work we do, it's all about channeling something into the world that the world needs as never before. This is why Bhante's talked about the order as the embodiment of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. It's not an image that appeals to everybody, I know. But he said, didn't he, that he means it literally. I think he means literally here, metaphorically. But what he's saying really is, I really mean it. We are trying to bring into reality in the world something that is more than us. Even something more than us individually, even something more than us collectively, and that can live in the world through us, that came to a small extent through me when I met those gypsies, and they then carry on to others. That's what it's all about as far as I'm concerned. And I constantly come back to what Shantideva says in the Bodhicharya Avatara, which I will not... I will do in a new translation. Indeed, the power of evil is very great. What can ordinary goodness do against it? Only the goodness that is the bodhicitta can counteract the weight of evil in the world. And that's what this is all about. Personally, this is what I'm committed to. I'm committed to working with you, my brothers and my sisters, to bring the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, to use that image, to bring this suprapersonal force. That's what Bhante meant there. You know, people reacted against the phrase, but what he's trying to get at is this sense, this experience of something more than oneself that one is channeling into the world. This inspiration, this lineage of inspiration, this special transmission outside the scriptures. We're trying together to make that live in the world. And we need to decide whether we're willing to make the effort to let that happen. The minimal effort to stay in tune with each other so that we can make that continue to live. I think we have to decide in the end. I think there are even different versions of the order. They all, you know, in a way, not necessarily invalid. But what I want is to be part of an order, a community, that is trying to go beyond itself as a community, individually, collectively, so that we channel the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara.